All right, we can turn to Matthew chapter 5 as we continue through this study of Gospel according to Matthew. So we turn there. Now, beginning in verse 17, Christ began to speak of the law. And of course, we've already gone over that. And he went on and spoke much of the law with regard to its application, the spiritual application of it, its reach, and so forth. And he continued on. And now, in our text today, truly, as we think of the law being briefly, of course, comprehended by the Ten Commandments, and we know what that means, but then also summed up this way, and of course I always add from Luke, and then there's Matthew, it's a little different, preaching at two different times, but love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, mind, and soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. What we're looking at today, really, as we look at this, is, of course, the law of love. It's the moral law is, in that sense, for the Christian, the law of love. But we see an application of that as we look at this today. We're reading 33 through 48 and hope to, Lord willing, cover that today. Again, ye have heard that it has been said of them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shalt perform unto the Lord thine oaths. But I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Neither shalt thou swear by thy head, because thou canst not make one hair white or black. But let your communication be, yea, yea, nay, nay. For whatsoever is more than these cometh of evil. Ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you that ye resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man will sue thee at the law, take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. Give to him that asketh of thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away. Ye have heard that it hath been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. For he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain for the just, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust. If ye love them which love you, what reward have ye? Do not even the publicans the same? And if ye salute your brethren only, what do ye more than others? Do not even the publicans so? Be therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. We begin then with verse 33. Again, ye have heard that it hath been said by them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shalt perform unto the Lord thine oaths. To forswear means to commit perjury. That is, to take an oath, but then not fulfill the conditions of the oath, whether this is testimony in court or with regard to binding oneself with an oath to some other obligation. The Jews had taught from old time under the old covenant law that they were not to swear falsely by the name of God. And of course, that's not just old covenant law, of course. That is the moral law of God. And if they did, it was also a profaning of his name, a taking his name in vain. So they were taught of old time. For instance, Leviticus 19, verse 12, and ye shall not swear by my name falsely, neither shalt thou profane the name of thy God. I am the Lord. Now these are yet, as we look at Christ speaking here and preaching and teaching from this mount he was on, these were Old Testament times yet. These were Old Covenant times. And it had been taught from old time that they were not to forswear themselves. The issue at hand comes under the ninth commandment, thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. A wrongful use of an oath is forbidden, as is a rightful use of an oath, but a breaking of it. I say forbidden, and it falls under then the ninth commandment. Oaths rightly used and faithfully kept are not sinful to take. When Abraham sent his servant to seek a wife for his son Isaac, he first had him swear an oath. We have this in Genesis 24, the verses 3 and 4. And I will make thee swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of the earth, that thou shalt not take a wife unto my son of the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I dwell. But thou shalt go into thine, but thou shalt go unto my country and to my kindred and take a wife unto my son Isaac. Oaths were prescribed by God under the old covenant, even in Old Testament times from the start, even before the institution ratification of the old covenant on Mount Sinai. They were prescribed by God for various reasons. You see, Abraham took an oath, or had his servant take an oath. And the thing is, though, the person taking the oath was always under an obligation to keep it, to fulfill all the terms of the oath. Now, we also have this in 2 Corinthians. Here's Paul. This is a form of an oath, what he says in 2 Corinthians 1, verses 23 and 24. Moreover, I call God for a record upon my soul, that to spare you I came not as yet unto Corinth. Not that we have dominion over your faith, but are helpers of your joy, for by faith ye stand. So he says, I call God for a record upon my soul. That is a form of an oath, and it is a serious thing that he said. Now, Hebrews 6, verse 16 through 20, we have this also in the New Testament. For men verily swear by the greater, and an oath for confirmation is to them an end of all strife. And, of course, you know, it goes on, speaks of God. And God confirming the immutability of his counsel, the promise to Abraham and the promise of the Christ to come by an oath. So God took an oath there. Amazing as that is, just for our comfort, of course, and encouragement, and especially for theirs before Christ came. And so we're saying there is a legitimate oath-taking, which God allows and even prescribes. But these legitimate oaths in the name of God are not to be lightly taken. And they are lightly taken these days. And in fact, people just take oaths lightly. What I'm saying is, you hear people use a form of an oath and think nothing of it. Now, with regard to legitimate oaths being taken lightly and violated, you can think of public officials taking an oath, their oath of office, and swearing, so help me God. And you can think of legal proceedings where people perjure themselves. When legitimate oaths are obviously violated, this does great, great harm to our nation, to individuals, to the cause of just plain public truth, so to speak. And also, it's a very, very great offense to God. Now, of course, there is much common and light oath-taking today. I alluded to that. We see that as well. For instance, what do we hear? We hear people say, honest to God, when they relate something. Honest to God, or I swear to God. That's a wrongful use of an oath, and consequently, it's taking the name of the Lord in vain. What the Lord teaches us here in our text, in verses 33 through, I believe it's 37, it does not forbid the taking of an oath in his name in a court of law or with regard to drawing up and signing a legitimate legal instrument. And we can, again, we look at the scriptures, we look at the Old Testament, we look at the New Testament, we look at God himself taking an oath, and so we see there is a rightful use. At the same time, Christ is teaching us that it is a very serious, solemn, and weighty matter to take an oath, even for a legitimate reason, and there are very few such reasons. Again, ye have heard that it hath been said by them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shalt perform unto the Lord thine oaths. Well, of course, this is true. And the scribes and Pharisees, they taught this. But in practice, they perverted it, and they violated the commandment. And that by the time Christ was teaching this, oaths were being taken very lightly and for all manner of reasons. And they were teaching that was just fine. They did it themselves. And because they were being taken lightly, they weren't being kept either then. In some cases, because the person had sworn an oath he just couldn't keep, or he had sworn an oath he could keep but had perhaps no intention of keeping it, or originally had an intention to keep it, then changed his mind after swearing it. And so in this, they were bearing a false witness, a form of false witness, and also they were taking the name of the Lord in vain. In some cases, the scribes and Pharisees attempted to exonerate themselves of taking the name of the Lord in vain with their light and promiscuous use of oaths. What they tried to do to exonerate themselves of that sort of sin, taking the name of the Lord in vain, is when they swore oaths or had others swear them, they taught them to do this in the name of heaven or in the name of earth and so forth, as the Lord speaks of here shortly. But even without swearing an oath directly in the name of the Lord, they were still making a sinful, promiscuous, wrong, light use of oaths, and thus often they were forswearing themselves on account of not keeping their oath as well. So they were bearing false witness, they were committing two sins there. Again, you have heard that it has been said by them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shalt perform unto the Lord thine oaths. And then next Christ goes on to rebuke and to warn the Pharisees and the scribes, of course, and what he's doing. I'm not saying there were any there on that Sermon on the Mount, but certainly he was doing this. And to warn against all light and false, certainly too, as well, swearing of oaths. Verse 34 and through 36, but I say unto you, swear not at all. Here the Lord forbids the ordinary, common, and often light-taking of oaths. You say, well, it doesn't say that. Scripture interprets Scripture. I've already given the basis for that as we looked at what said in Hebrews, what the Apostle Paul did, what God himself did, what Abraham did, what Joseph did, and we can see other cases in the Old Testament. They weren't sinning, any of these, of course. Of course, I speak of the men there. But I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven. So it's not just light-taking of oaths in God's name, but all light-taking of oaths. Neither by heaven, for it is God's throne. Here he rebukes the sophistry of the scribes and Pharisees who justified light and promiscuous oath-taking, even if the name of God was not used. But yet, men want to give weight to an oath, so they would swear by heaven. But here the Lord reproves and exposes the sinfulness and folly of that strategy by declaring, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne. To swear an oath wrongly in the name of heaven still breaks the commandment, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord in vain. It speaks of the Lord and heaven, which is his throne, speaks of this in a light way, irreverent way, and that is taking the name of the Lord in vain. Any misuse of the Lord's name is a taking of it in vain. It doesn't have to be what you often think of, the really horrible cursing or something like that. And when such an oath is broken then, as such light and common oaths frequently are, there was still, it's still a bearing of false witness. It is an exceeding serious thing to swear an oath, and it must be done for only several legitimate reasons. We think of a court proceeding when one is testifying and so much is at stake. Justice, maybe liberty, maybe life itself. And we think of perhaps to execute a vital legal document or some such thing. Now, if in a court of law a man's conscience will not allow him to swear in the name of God, then he should simply affirm to tell the truth. In our country, we have that liberty. The law allows him to do that as it should. It allows for conscience sake, but I will say it's still an oath. And it's still taken in the name of God. That is, the oath includes many times, I would say always, any oaths I've heard in court or seen in court or so forth, it's so help me God. And so the person rather than says I do, they say I affirm, because it starts out, do you swear? So they change it to do you affirm, and then you say I do, I guess. But I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne. And then for those who would have said, well, then swear by the earth, Christ immediately declares, nor by the earth, for it is his footstool, neither by Jerusalem. Don't go there either, for it is the city of the great king. So to give weight to even a light and common oath, men swear by God, and if not by God, well, then something which has great and weighty significance. That's what they were doing. They were using other devices, but the earth belongs to God. And Jerusalem at that time was the city of God himself, the great king. And so to swear an oath for a common reason, and even if not directly in the name of God, and even if not a common reason, but still it's not a proper oath, it's there's no intention of carrying it out, even if it's a very compelling and necessary reason, to misuse an oath, and certainly one way or another, as they were doing, misuse the name of the Lord by swearing by heaven or swearing by earth, swearing by God, whichever it was, swearing by the city that was the city of the great king then, their holy city, the seat of their religion. It was all sinful. It was a vain use of the name of God, and it was a wrongful use of oaths often as well. And then in verse 37, the Lord warns with regard to swearing an oath, neither shalt thou swear by thy head, because thou canst not make one hair white or black. What he's talking about is by a man's own power. Obviously, we know what people do these days. They make white hair black, but with chemicals or whatever. But what we're talking about here is by one's own power. The fact that we cannot, by our own power, make one hair of our head black or white proves then what? That God is sovereign over us, his creatures. Thus, to try and circumvent the law against common and light use of oaths by not using God's name, but only something of great weight and significance to the one swearing, is still forbidden. It's forbidden by God, and it's offensive to God, was then, still is. So to be clear, the Savior in these verses that we've been considering thus far warns against the breaking of legitimate oaths, but also the light and common use of oaths for any reason that's not, of course, proper and legitimate. Whether it's sworn in the oath in God's name or sworn by heaven or earth or any of his creation. Put it that way, any of his creation. That covers it, doesn't it? Verse 37, but let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay, for whatsoever is more than these cometh of evil. Communication and communications in the New Testament sometimes comprehends our interaction overall with others, our words and our deeds. Here, communication is translated from the original language, and certainly as we look at the context, obviously means our words, only our words. Here's what's directly spoken of, and as I say, the context makes that plain. Now, first of all, this confirms this, but let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay, for whatsoever is more than these cometh of evil. First of all, then, this confirms that the issue at hand is the light common usage of oaths, not the legitimate use of oaths, as we've already explained. But let your communication be. In other words, when speaking with each other in our day-to-day interactions, our conversation with others, we're not talking about legitimate use of an oath here, our dealings with others just day-to-day, and maybe even if we agree, yes, I'll do that, someone's yes, will you take that job? Yes, I'll take that job, or whatever it might be, or agree to help someone else with something, or whatever it might be. That's what's being spoken of. We're just supposed to say yay or nay. In other words, yes, I will do that, or no, I will not do that, or whatever the case is. The issue is not an oath in the name of God in court or sealing a legal instrument under the penalty of perjury for willingly giving false information. No, no. But let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay. Simply put, our word should be our bond. We should not need an oath for something like that. Our word should be our bond, even without an oath. If we agree with another to do or deliver or provide or accomplish something, then we must do that. The only exception is if something happens which we could not foresee. See, that's the problem with light oath-taking, because that can happen. I mean, something you just can't foresee, and there's no way you could have foreseen it or stopped what happened. And then somehow you can't follow through. But even there, we have to be ready then to make good, insofar as we're able, any inconvenience or loss caused to others. And so even with our yeas and our nays, we ought not to be light. We're not supposed to be taking oaths or something like that. Just yea and nay. Even without an oath before the Lord and day-to-day commitments, he does hold us responsible to our yeas and our nays. And certainly, you talk day-to-day, let's talk about baptism. When we were baptized, did we not agree to walk after the Spirit, to walk after Christ, to serve the Lord, to worship him, to seek him, to seek to conform to his word in our evangelical obedience as new creatures? And of course, that was part of being taken into the membership of the church with duties to that church. And so, you know, there too, yea, yea. Otherwise, we shouldn't have got baptized, because that's part of it. But let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay, for whatsoever is more than these cometh of evil. And this, for whatsoever is more than these cometh of evil, there's a warning, with the context being what the Lord's been reproving and rebuking, just the wrongful use of oaths and the light use of oaths. Nothing good can come of that. Such oaths do not come of righteousness. They're not lawful. And it's not a righteous use of an oath, but rather such oaths cometh of evil. Their origin is evil. It is sinful. It is unlawful. And it will bear bad fruit. So in that sense, evil. Bear evil. Now verse 38. You have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. This was the judicial law of Moses, that the malicious, purposeful injuring of another person would be punished by a like injury, but only after a due process of law and the sentence executed only by the rightful civil authority. It's not to say there wasn't room for mercy by the one that had been wronged either, that he could intercede for something lesser even. But now, as I've explained more than once, and why the judicial law of Moses was of the old covenant only and not suited to the new covenant economy of things other than to discover general equity of law, and we won't go back to that. Certainly it's clear from this, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, the punishment for a crime, if you think of equity, going to discover general equity of law, the punishment for a crime must, as they say, fit the crime. In other words, it must be the proper, just, equitable, and fitting punishment for the crime. It must not be more, and insofar as possible, not less, unless there is some mitigating circumstance and cause for mercy. We ought not to totally rule mercy out as long as we are not in some way aborting justice. Now, the Lord Jesus is not speaking against the judicial law of Moses. He's not coming against that law as if it's wrong. It was still in force. Since Israel was under the old covenant at this time and continued so until Christ Jesus inaugurated and ratified the new covenant with his shed blood. The problem was the scribes and the Pharisees were teaching this as a law of personal revenge. In other words, if one of them was wronged, they claimed a right to seek personal revenge by getting back at that person by some means they saw as equivalent with the wrong. In other words, they claimed a right to get even with the person and inflict what harm they felt he had due. Maybe his reputation, maybe his material worth, maybe even his person. So they claim by an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, not that it's just equity in punishment by the civil authorities, the proper authorities. No, no. That's the law of personal revenge. Now this is in the context then of what follows in verse 39. You see, that's the context of it, I should say, verse 39. But I say unto you, you have to understand, again, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. It was the law of personal revenge they taught. It's not. So the Lord says, but I say unto you that ye resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. Resist not evil does not mean Christians are to accommodate evil. They're not to preach against evil. They're not to warn of evil. They're not to resist evil. none of that's true. And we are to abhor evil. The issue is personal revenge. This that the Lord declares does not prohibit self-defense or defense of others, even using physical force as necessary, but only as necessary and to the degree necessary and what would be prudent and right for that situation. What Christ forbids is the taking of personal revenge, and certainly in small things even. This example then is given, what he says, to turn the other cheek. It's given as a figure, the smiting on the cheeks for personal insults and wrongs, that sort of evil. Even things, too, that are of a minor nature as well as the more major. This doesn't mean we're forbidden to set the record straight if another is bearing false witness against us, spreading malicious lies and so forth. Certainly sometimes we have to. It's right. It would be wrong not to respond in such a case and set the record straight with truth. And that includes certainly when a minister of Christ would be slandered and defamed by men or women within the visible church, though they may not be necessarily of the true spiritual church. But as Christians, we are not to return evil for evil. We're to bear with some of these things for the cause of Christ, for the sake of Christ and his church, and as a testimony of the power of regeneration. We're to be willing to bear with certain insults that might come our way for being Christian as to our worship and service, but also as to our way of life and our walk. So the Lord makes plain here, if we're wronged or insulted in some way, which was not does not require for truth or justice's sake to set the record straight, you're out in the world. And this chiefly pertains to the world. We would hope within the church we don't have a lot of this sort of smiting on the cheek, we might say, and those things need to be dealt with, of course. But you're out in the world, and there's some sort of, well, you think you've been wrong. You think you've been insulted. Unless it's necessary for truth's sake, justice's sake, or some such thing, to set the record straight, it's better, though, not to seek revenge, but also to turn the other cheek. That is to act with some of these things as if it never happened. Just show some grace in the matter. This will be for our good, the good of the cause of Christ, Lord willing, the good of the one doing the smiting, so to speak. We don't have to just return evil for evil. Someone makes an insult, someone makes some sort of remark, someone, whatever it might be, we don't have to immediately return evil for evil. You can just act as though it never happened. The contrary to this is if one smites us on the cheek, so to speak, to immediately lash out and smite him back on the cheek. That is, get even and repay him. Sort of like sometimes kids do. Oh, yeah? And then you just give it right back. Now, this is not to say we have to stand by mute or idle if someone literally smites a brother or a sister. But even if it's with their tongue, there is a time where, no, you don't just stand there. You say something, or if necessary, you do something if there's some sort of physical smiting. But I say unto you that ye resist not evil. The context being, again, is as we go through life and there's some, we're out in the world and there's some sort of personal insult or some sort of whatever it means, the small things like that. But whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. Verse 40, and if any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy cloak, let him have thy cloak. And take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. What's meant by this? If any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. It's very simple. In a dispute concerning some small thing, represented here by a coat, we're not to fight it out in court before the world, so to speak. As Christians, of course, with other Christians, we need to settle these things without court. But as Christians, we also, with regard to the world, people in the world, we need to avoid going into court over especially smaller matters. Try to settle things without going into court, even if it's something bigger. But with smaller matters, it would even be better to just state the truth of the matter plainly and clearly with all the facts and evidence to the person, and hopefully if there's witnesses there. And then if he won't relent, then let it go, rather than wind up in court over some small thing. We have to take care not to let our pride or frustration with that person or a desire to teach them a lesson dictate our actions, lest we bring reproach on the cause of Christ and even embroil ourselves in more than we thought. It could become a very, very bitter legal contest that started out with something small and ends up with a lot of animosity, bitterness, and hatred. All this over some petty thing. And so Christ declares, if any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. That is, then, if it can be done without giving the impression of dishonesty on our part, we don't want to do that, or done in a way that it wouldn't disregard our responsibilities that we have, we should, as I mentioned, state the matter plainly, clearly, with facts and evidence to the person. And then if they just won't accept the truth, will not relent, they continue to say no, no, and they insist on having it their way and it's some smaller thing, just let it go. Let him have the coat, so to speak, and if need be, you go the extra mile and he can have the cloak as well. There's a way to do it without endorsing what he has done. In other words, be kind, be gracious, but without giving the impression you're in the wrong, only that you would rather be just that, kind and gracious. Rather do that than get into a bitter court battle over some misunderstanding with some small thing, maybe a small financial matter. So this isn't to say we should accommodate scam artists. We're not going to accommodate scam artists that do this for a living, for instance, or accommodate dishonesty in business and personal dealings. This is more a misunderstanding. Yes, the person ought to know. Yes, they're being stubborn. Yes, they're being prideful themselves, but it's a genuine misunderstanding between parties. And even there, even a Christian is expected by the Lord to just let a misguided, confused, and probably hard-headed individual go so far as to harm his family, the Christian's family. I mean, a small financial loss, for instance, is one thing, but inflicting actual harm of a more substantial nature is quite another. Then you begin to abrogate your responsibility to your family. The individual has to decide how far this goes. So there's a lot to this, but we're talking about smaller things, and as a Christian, we don't have to always get our way with some of these. It's better to act in a very wise way and a gracious way and yet an honest way and a straightforward way. And in the end, that person might end up feeling pretty ashamed of himself, or at least other people will see that you truly are living out your Christian profession and he really is being blessed to deal with such a gracious man. Now, just now I used the expression, go the extra mile, though. This is an old expression, isn't it? It's much older than most in the world realizes. It traces right back to these words of the Savior in verse 41. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. Well, of course, this doesn't mean a person walks up to you out of the blue on the street and says, hey, I want you right now to walk a mile with me. When you have to do it right then, you've got to go 2 miles with him, not just one. But the Lord is stressing here with this example is that in our interaction dealing with others, certainly including in the world, we ought to be willing to accommodate another when we can do so without encouraging sin of any kind or doing harm to anyone. We ought to seek to be a kind, gracious people in so much as it depends on us. Kind and gracious, this is not synonymous with weak and spineless. Kind and gracious doesn't mean falling down before evil men or countenancing behavior that plainly calls for a rebuke. Kind and gracious are just that, seeking to show understanding and kindness and act and speak in a gracious way day to day as much as possible. And so that's what it means, just go the extra mile. We've heard that saying, and you know the right application of it. Well, we'll just go the extra mile with him. We'll be a little patient here. We'll see, you know, what we can do here, so to speak. Next, the Lord sets forth how the Christian ought to respond to those in true need. True need. Now, he says, go the extra mile. Go too, if you have to. Now, that speaks of being gracious. We don't have to say, I don't you know, I don't have to do that. I mean, technically, I don't have to do that, or I don't have to help him out with that, or I don't have to go the extra mile, be a little patient as a Christian, and be gracious. Verse 42, though, give to him that asketh thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away. Now, this is people in true need. And Christians cannot help every person in need. As to those in need, a Christian's first responsibility is to family members. Now, that should not be wrongfully used to be selfish, of course. I mean, when you say family members, yeah, my family members, I just can't get enough luxury for our family. I can't get enough. Now, you know that can be misused, but you understand what I'm saying. Now, with the context being immediate family, as we say first responsibility to family members, well, we think of children, even though they're grown up. If there's a situation where a child needs help, truly needs help from a parent, even grown up children, you don't want to spoil them. You know, they gotta make their way. It's good for them to have some challenges and even some hard times. But if there's a situation of true need, and then there's father and there's mother. And fathers and mothers should not want to there's times when they might need help, especially when they get a lot older. But as far as financially, they should really want to avoid being some kind of a burden that way. But if something happens, then there's aunts and uncles in true need, as we see in Paul's first epistle to Timothy, in true need and having no immediate family to help them. 1 Timothy 5, verse 8, but if any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his own house, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. And it does speak of more than just beyond the immediate family there, as we talked of aunts, uncles. Now, the Christian's next or second responsibility concerning those in material need, as we think of material need, is their Christian brethren of the local church and then the church in general. Galatians 6, verse 10, and as we have therefore opportunity, let us do good unto all men, especially unto them who are of the household of faith. In James chapter 2, the verses 14 and 16, speaking of true faith and false faith, and speaking of how the one with true faith has works, and so he is justified by his testimony that he does have faith in Christ, because there are works. What doth it profit, my brethren, though a man say he have faith and have not works? And then an example of faith is given, or I should say of a work is given. He says, can faith save him? In other words, that sort of faith, faith without works. Is that a true saving, justifying, saving faith? No, it's not. And we've been all the way through that whole passage. We won't today. We've done it several times. If a brother or sister, see, the household of faith, be naked and destitute of daily food, in other words, very short on clothing, in need of maybe warm clothing, whatever it might be, and destitute of daily food. This is a truly needy person, isn't it? And one of you say unto them, depart in peace, be ye warmed and filled. Notwithstanding, ye give them not those things which are needful for the body, what doth it profit? And then with all this, the Christian is not to turn a blind eye to any obvious duties given him to help someone in the world who's in genuine need and brought to him, so to speak, by the Lord, or comes into his view, so to speak, or across his path, as Christians have the ability to do so. I know that in these days of the welfare state, and when there are so many people who just work the system and take what they can get from all sources, and not hesitating even to use deception to take all they can get, there are really not all that many opportunities to get involved in helping people in the world with just material need. And of course, what is true need? But sometimes there are such opportunity. Maybe you might live next to someone who really falls on hard times, and you know them and you trust them, and you have an opportunity there to help them, to do good to them, to do good to them. And it's the context of give to him that asketh thee. We don't have to wait till we're asked. But if there's someone, I just gave the example of a neighbor that makes his need plain and asks in that way, and there's a true need, they're in a real strait, they're in a bad situation, we can help them. And there's other opportunities. I remember the Hmong people in the 70s after the Vietnam War that came here, and there were some in the area, you know, a lot of them. They were in true need, and there was an opportunity given then to help those people. Now, certainly, through trusted and sound evangelical ministries, which we support, we're able to help the poor of this world as well. And so these ministries have the gospel at the heart, but they also help with other needs. Galatians 6, verse 10 says, as we have therefore opportunity, I already quoted it, but let us do good unto all men, and of course then especially unto them who are of the household of faith. So them first, but all men. Christians are called and commanded here in our text to have a great concern for those in need. We're not to be a stingy people, but a generous people, willing according to our ability to give to those in true need by direct giving and by willing to help others by lending things even, as the opportunity might be. Sometimes we can lend something to someone in need even. Now, as far as giving, Paul holds up the churches of Macedonia, which were anything but well off, and they gave liberally to help the poor brethren that were suffering in Jerusalem at that time. 2 Corinthians 8, the verses 1 through 4. Moreover, brethren, we do you to wit of the grace of God bestowed on the churches of Macedonia, how that in a great trial of affliction, the abundance of their joy and their deep poverty abounded unto the riches of their liberality. For to their power I bear record, yea, and beyond their power they were willing of themselves, praying us with much entreaty that we would receive the gift and take upon us the fellowship of the ministering to the saints. Now, Paul gives that example to the Corinthians by way of really a rebuke and a challenge. The rich Corinthians, it was a rich area, a rich church in general, and yet they were holding back. And he said, look at these people, persecuted, very poor, they're in poverty, and they gave beyond what one would have thought they would have even been able to give. And so it wasn't just that they were, for instance, just giving a tithe at church and saying, okay, that covers it. They saw a need of these brethren in Jerusalem, and they just gave. Faith and charity. Charity, of course, that feeling, doing Christian love, ought to motivate us to be as the Savior urges us to be in this text. And we do also have 2 Corinthians 9, 6 through 11, which has to do with that same situation, Jerusalem, and giving to help brethren. But this I say, he which soweth sparingly shall reap also sparingly, and he which soweth bountifully shall reap also bountifully. It doesn't mean you're going to get rich. You can reap spiritual things when you give material things, can't you? But God will take care of us. That we know. God will bless those who do so bountifully, both spiritually and in other ways, that they sow bountifully. He will take care. And sometimes there will be a prospering even materially. I mean, we don't speak of this awful situation with these, what do they call them, prosperity preachers and Christians and so forth. But you know what I mean. Every man according as he has purposeth in his heart. And speaking of this special collection, if you will, for Jerusalem. So let him give, not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loveth a cheerful giver. And God is able to make all grace abound toward you, that ye, always having all sufficiency in all things, may abound in every good work. As it is written, this is from Psalm, what is it? I think it's Psalm 112, but don't quote me on that, but it's from a psalm. As it is written, he hath dispersed abroad, he hath given to the poor, his righteousness remaineth forever. Now he that ministereth seed to the sower both minister bread for your food and multiply your seed sown and increase the fruits of your righteousness. And so he's asking there for a blessing both upon them spiritually, but also that the Lord will bless them in other ways as far as the things they need for this world. So we have the righteousness, and we also have bread for your food. Being enriched in everything to all bountifulness, which causeth through us thanksgiving to God. Give to him that asketh thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not away. Now, as I said, the issue here is true immediate need. We are We are forbidden to encourage irresponsibility and laziness. For instance, 2 Thessalonians 3, verse 10, "For even when we were with you, this we commanded you, that if any would not work, neither should he eat. We likewise must strictly avoid indulging the soft and spoiled, who think they have needs, but what they have is wants." They don't have needs. And even if they have some needs, they're not in a situation where they can't work their way out. Nowadays, if people are by necessity in a little debt because maybe they had some bad judgment too, or otherwise it's just some necessity, something they couldn't help, immediately they start whining about and think they ought not to have this. They don't have to be simply patient, tighten their belt as much as necessary, and doggedly work their way out of the debt. That builds character. We don't want to take that away from people. But that's not to say we can't help others. I mean, even sometimes if a Christian brother or sister falls into some situation, medical thing or something, maybe in many years they could work their way out of it. Maybe we do want to help out in a situation like that. I'm not saying that. But you know what I am saying. Let's not accommodate the many whiners of the world these days that don't know what it's like to just simply say, "Well, now I've got to work my way out of this. With God's help, I will." And we just keep at it. It's not going to be in 6 months, maybe. It maybe won't be in a year. It might take me 10 years, but God willing, I'll work my way out of it, whatever it takes. And so we want to encourage that kind of understanding, too. We don't want to encourage this situation that we see now. Many think, well, everything should always be good for me. I shouldn't ever have any debt. I should be able to buy what I want to buy, live the way I want to live. Well, I'm not going to be any part of that myself in encouraging that. It's not the way it ought to be. It's not the way it used to be. Now, as I said, it's not to say we can't help others. Certainly Christian brethren who fall in hard times, even if in time, maybe a long time, they could work their way out of it. I'm just saying we have to take care not to encourage those who think they should never have financial hard times at all, nor should they have to patiently and doggedly work their way out of them. In fact, many people today, including Christians, don't really know what it's like to have genuinely hard financial times, and one misfortune follows another, and the list of the debts, maybe no fault of their own, gets longer and longer. Maybe it goes into the second column. And they have to take what they have and divide it up, and they have to just keep going. They don't know what that's like. Someone always picks up the tab somewhere. Someone's always been there to take care of that. Now, I don't know if all of you realize it or not, but as we're speaking of meeting our responsibilities to those in need, that falls under the sixth commandment, which comprehends our duties to our neighbor's physical and spiritual and moral welfare and safety, while also comprehending all sins having to do with the same thing. Verse 43, "Ye have heard it hath been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. As you know, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself," briefly comprehends the moral law and our duties to our neighbor. Christ again uses then this expression, "Ye have heard that it hath been said." The moral law has been from the creation, as we've stressed many times, the will of God for man's obedience, and it still is. "As for thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself," and I realize Christ doesn't say it that way, we'll get to that, "but as to thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself," that's found in writing, if you will, back in Leviticus 19:18 for the first time. "Thou shalt not avenge, nor bear any grudge against the children of thy people, but thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. I am the Lord." And so it had been said of old, "Thou shalt love thy neighbor." In fact, "Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself." But as was the case with so many commands of the Lord, the Pharisees and the scribes had perverted the word of the Lord to suit their own wants, desires, ambitions, and even lusts. So Christ, speaking in the immediate sense to a multitude of Jews, said, "Ye have heard that it hath been said." In other words, under the old covenant and all the way back, they were still under the old covenant. "Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself." Well, he doesn't say as thyself. "And hate thine enemy." That's what was being said. All the way back, it was said, "Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself." I should amend what I said. But it had been said in more recent times by the scribes and Pharisees, "And hate thine enemy." So this was a perversion of the commandment that the Pharisees and scribes taught at that time and had been teaching for quite some time. Thou shalt love thy neighbor. True enough, although you see thyself was left off by the self-centered legalistic Pharisees and scribes. They could not imagine having that there, I'm sure, but that must be why Christ left it off. Not saying they always left it off, but be that as it may, what was being taught as the word and law of God was this: thou shalt love thy neighbor, but then they added this, and hate thine enemy. As we know, that's not the moral law of God. It's not the second of the two commandments which briefly comprehend the ten and the whole moral law. Further, we're told by brethren, we see it in the Bible, first of all, of course. There was a hatred by the Jews of all Gentiles, just a hatred. And we're told also by competent brethren with a very historically correct knowledge of Jewish culture and teachings at that time that this was the way it was. The Jews, as I say, we see in the Bible, obviously they hate everyone, these legalistic Jews, except who? Their fellow Jews. And so they hated everyone. They hated everyone. They didn't define their neighbor as being mankind. Love thy neighbor as thyself. And so they hated their neighbor. And this was not the law. This was not the Old Testament. This was not the Old Covenant. It's not the moral law today, obviously. The moral law is the same. You have this in Deuteronomy 23, verse 7. Thou shalt not abhor an Edomite, for he is thy brother. Of course, the children of Esau, so they were sort of cousins that way, brothers that way with the Jews. But thou shalt not abhor an Egyptian, because thou wast a stranger in his land. So they weren't supposed to abhor the Egyptians even. They weren't supposed to hate everyone except the Jews, and probably some of them, if it was a personal enemy, they hated them. And of course, in his parable, the Good Samaritan, Christ confronted a legalist with the true and right understanding of the commandment, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. The man wishing to justify himself, and you know the whole parable, we won't go through it, wanting to justify himself by his own works, asked, and who is my neighbor? And so then Jesus told that parable of the Good Samaritan. And then he said this, Luke 10, verse 36, and then through 37, which now of these three thinkest thou was neighbor unto him that fell among the thieves? And he said, he that showed mercy on him. Then said Jesus unto him, go and do thou likewise. Matthew 7, verse 12, we're not to hate our enemy. We're not to hate everyone except our family and our immediate brethren, those that do good unto us, and our friends. We love our neighbor as thyself. And we'll explain that more in context in a minute. Matthew 7, verse 12, therefore all things whatsoever ye would that men should do to you, do ye even so to them, for this is the law and the prophets. Now remember, that's addressed to us who are the Lord's children. Those who are in the world would get some of that right, but they'd get some of it wrong, wouldn't they? You know, they would want people to do things for them that, you know, to accommodate sin and other things and help them in it. So this is directed to, especially to those who are the children of God. And whatsoever ye would that men should do to you, do ye even so to them, for this is the law and the prophets. Romans 13, verse 10, love worketh no ill to his neighbor, neither by omission or commission, of course. Therefore, love is the fulfilling of the law. Love thy neighbor as thyself. We break here.